This week on The Droids, we're talking Chapter 21 of The Mandalorian, The Pirate, a single episode focused on Nevarro. And will Nevarro be saved? Who's going to save it? Is it going to be the New Republic, or will it be Din and the Mandalorians? All that and more on The Droids.
These are the droids you're looking for.
I'm no one.
It's always a bigger fish.
Hello there.
Rebellion's built on hope.
Welcome back to The Droids You're Looking For, a Star Wars podcast. And this is a very special edition of The Droids. Ryan, I'm calling this Wake Up with Mando. You may be listening to this at some other hour, but this is early in the morning for the two of us. And on this edition of Wake Up with Mando, we've got 6 tips to help your family navigate dueling, a lovely recipe for Grogu macaroons, and we'll show you a parcel of land that is perfect for a weekend getaway or to rebuild your once mighty society. But Ryan, first, tell us about your weekend in a Wrath Tar pit.
Well, let me first start off with that. I love this bit, and I wish that I had, because it is the morning, I wish that I had the mental fortitude to continue on with it instead of stopping it dead like I am right now. I loved that. It is early. This is kind of, and the listeners may not know this, this is kind of like where I live. I live my life early in the morning is kind of like what's going on for Ryan.
You're living the opposite life of me.
Yeah, well, you're burning the candle at both ends, my man.
Always.
You're out there doing it. So I watch The Mandalorian early. I wake up early and watch it, and then we're recording early. And if you're not listening to this early in the morning, we must request to match our energy that you stop listening, and then the next early morning you can listen then. But and if this is, I watch the Today Show many days, and if it's anything like the Today Show, we should have a segment about a crazily irresponsible reporting segment about Ozempic and how to get it cheaply, okay, which is a thing they've been doing. I don't have much of a platform to say this, but I think that the Today Show has been doing some very irresponsible reporting.
Well, I think they can just inject that into like some sort of Bantha tank or whatever, one of the restoring tanks.
Banthas have been a little slim on the show.
Too much Ozempic.
So Grogu macaroons, I sure hope that those are macaroons that Grogu enjoys and not macaroons made of Grogu.
Well, it really depends. If the bounty that we've put out has come through, then they're going to be made of Grogu. If it's for a more general audience, then sure. They're just ones he ate.
Could you imagine
that he recommends.
If the big reveal that, you know, Werner Herzog's character and that guy that was in that terrible episode of The Mandalorian a few weeks ago, their main plan was just that Grogu was like a delicacy.
Yeah. Oh.
They just thought he tasted real good.
The whole show ends in similar to the menu, and it's just a plate that's so finely
he's
refined.
He's being cutely placed into a crock pot, and like they're like salting him like a cartoon.
No. I'm just thinking of, it's like a dark restaurant where Mandalorians can eat and take off their helmet in peace because there's no light and no one's around them, and they bring out the dish and he's ready to eat and it looks so spectacular, and then they're like, please enjoy your son.
Oh my god, Mike, that gave me chills. That was upsetting. I'll be honest. My cartoonish version, he was still alive and kind of just but you're saying that it's more of a Ray Liotta and Hannibal situation.
Yeah, a little
bit. Where the well, the realization
I like that
is
in
that
this
they've already eaten it.
In this podcast, we've gone from the most general audience wake up morning show to dark, cannibalistic. Well, not cannibal, because it's Grogu and Din. They're not the same species, but you know.
Right. It's still reprehensible.
Is but, there a term for when you eat your family? I wonder.
Nature. No, I don't know. We should do next week, we should do like a morning zoo. You know,
yeah. Oh,
we
there
have,
you
like,
go.
An intro and like, you know, it's a bunch of.
Well, and
come
then
on, guys.
We would really need to talk about our sex lives and the sex lives that you have out in Star Wars, which is really more appropriate for an Andor recap, right?
It is, and if it was a morning zoo show where it's like, you know, I'm in New York, so it'd be like Z100. It's like they're talking about it, but like in this very like watered down way where they're like, I mean, I'm not going to say anything about that one, you know, like that kind of.
You know, it's so funny. I did not know what Z100 was, having not lived in New York until area until a few years ago. And a friend of mine was like, I got a job on Z100. I was like, oh, cool. I don't know. Is that a big deal? I had no idea. And clearly it was a very big deal.
I'm actually a little starstruck that they worked at Z100, that they're in such close proximity to Elvis Duran and the Z Morning Zoo. But so you're from Chicago. I mean, well, WBZ is like an NPR affiliate.
Yeah,
what's like a big like pop radio station there?
It's interesting. It's 101.9 The Mix. And 101.9 The Mix was, they had a morning zoo and it was called Eric and Kathy in the Morning. And I know everyone who's a Star Wars fan is enjoying this dive
Love
into
it.
Morning radio.
Huge Eric and Kathy in the Morning fans out there.
There's got to be a few. I'm sure someone just write in. Unfortunately, that show is done because Eric had a few dalliances that then came to light and it is no more. So
right.
That is over. But that
was
35
years.
Yeah.
Most morning zoos went the way of Eric, it seems, or just that they were bought out by weird Christian radio stations and the whole station went out of business.
That
which
happens.
Is a thing that's happening.
Yep. Well, Ryan, I say when we have our continuing episodes of Wake Up with Mando, we keep it all above board, and we're able to do this for the next 2-3 decades, because that's really what I think we should be able to pull off, and I think there's a lot of topics we can talk about. I want people
that's
to call
we
in.
We are the future of radio.
Yeah. I want people to call in and tell us about their past relationships and the craziest thing that they ever did in the back of a speeder.
But don't, keep it PG,
you
know?
Yeah, yeah. You got to give us all the giggles, but don't actually tell us, you know, the real deets.
Yeah, and we get the one caller who, like, they don't know, they can't read the social cues that we're, like, rushing them for time.
All right, so
anyway,
Ryan,
so chapter 21.
You were not here for the discussion of chapters 19 and 20, which was the convert and the foundling. I think you kind of already alluded to your thoughts on the Andor, not Andor episode with Dr. Pershing. Did you appreciate some of the, like, did you like going back to the opera? I guess is my direct question.
Thank you for bringing this up. I was very excited that we were going back to the opera at first.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because one, they made it look fake the way that the prequels look fake.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which I thought was cool because we've been in that literal like location.
Yep.
So at first I was very excited. I thought, oh my goodness, this is like a bubble episode, and like the beginning and the end of it were very exciting. And then it kept happening. And I thought the idea of the amnesty program was very interesting for the world. That's a thing we haven't seen before. And then there was a lot of like glowing popsicles and like bad volume work. And that guy's performance was a problem for me.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. He seemed a little bit like a robot. It was like a ChatGPT performance. I did not like that episode. I did not think it was well done, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
This season, it gets me every year. Every year that The Mandalorian comes in, there's a lot of like the first three episodes are absolute bangers, and then there's a lot of like wheel spinning.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like we talked about in the first episode how relieved we were that they seemed to be setting up a huge quest, and then they kind of did it all in two episodes, and it was like, oh, that's exciting. And as it goes on, you realize that they wrapped it up too quickly, and now we're not doing anything.
It's so weird. I mean, it's more so in this season than it was in the prior two seasons as well.
Right.
I mean, I agree. I was like, kind of like, wow, this is awesome. They're going to Mandalore right away. We're not going to actually drag this out. Instead, they're just dragging out nothing. They're just like, we don't have a mission right now, but we're going to, you know, continue to drag it out. There is clearly an underlying story that they're building to. So I shouldn't be too dismissive of it, but it feels less involving of, like we've talked about prior, it's not an underlying story about what Mando and Grogu are doing. It's an underlying story about how the First Order came to be and how Palpatine returned.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of setting up things that have long since been forgotten, which can be exciting because it's like, you know, now we have an extra chance at these things. But Yeah, it always seems it seems really imbalanced to me this season, and I can't describe it as anything else than like wheel spinning, including the action. There's all these action scenes, and we've talked about this ad nauseum on the podcast. And listen, you can go at me at the reviews and say that I don't like Star Wars, whatever, because I do. But like, I do like Star Wars, obviously.
Yeah.
But the action scenes sometimes are very strong, but sometimes it's literally just there's really no conflict here. We're just waiting for them to succeed. If that makes sense. Like, there's no. We've said this, like, every action scene that's good, there's usually an obstacle and like a clear goal, and sometimes it's just like there are a lot of good guys and a lot of bad guys, and we're just waiting for the bad guys to be less than the good guys. And that's how it feels a lot in the last few episodes, that it's just like, okay, like, yeah, this is an action scene, but really, like, it's not doing anything for me.
No. Do you think it's a bit of a function, though, of being someone well versed in so much cinema and so much action storytelling? Do you think like a 12-year-old is on the edge of their seat with this?
Oh my God. First off, thank you so much. Well, okay. So this is a thing also that I was talking to my wife about when we were watching it. And this is where I want to be very aware, which is that this show is not for me.
Yeah.
And that's fine. You know what I mean? Like, that's totally cool. If this is working for a 12-year-old, I don't know any 12-year-olds, but if this is working for a 12-year-old, that's great, because that's who this show is for.
If you're 12 and listening to the pod, you know, talk to your parents, have both of you email us, and we'll bring you on the pod, and your parent can join as well.
Yes, absolutely. You know, tell your parents that you're using an email or whatever. You know, I don't know what the...
I think 12-year-olds have emails.
Yeah, sure. I'm sure I did at 12. But and that's fine. We always talk about these fans on the podcast, and I don't want to be one of these people, and I want to be very aware of it, which is that if Star Wars, or aspects of Star Wars is what I should say, because Andor certainly is not for children. If aspects of Star Wars are not made for me, I need to be able to view them that way and be like, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't think that this is the strongest version of a show for a young person.
No, it's not.
Necessarily. And I think that it's one of those things where watching it through that lens, it may be exciting, or the mileage may vary, you know, for someone younger. But that doesn't mean that I think that younger people deserve like lazier, not well-paced stories.
Yeah.
And I think that, not that I'm saying it's lazy, but it's certainly not well-paced. And also, action in a show for young people can still be exciting and have obstacles and be like, well, you know, have clear intention. And I don't necessarily think it's always doing that.
At times it does. I think you talked about the beginning of The Convert, where it was that space battle or that dogfight with Mando and Bo-Katan and the TIE fighters.
Oh, that was great. Because it was a clear thing. They were trying to get to something.
Yeah.
We knew exactly what everybody's intentions were and what was at stake.
Yep.
I thought that was extremely exciting. Because it was like, oh, great. Like, this is made clear. It's coherent. All of those things.
On the flip side, the pirate, the episode that we're talking about today, I think it's clear what is happening. They're trying to save Nevarro. The pirates are trying to destroy Nevarro. They want to take over the planet. However, we don't know capabilities of that pirate ship. We don't really know how many pirates are there. There's a little bit of this vagueness of, wait, why aren't their shields working at all from the very beginning, like the first shot that Mando takes? And this is getting a little bit too much into the nitty-gritty of it, but I didn't feel a lot of, as we've talked about, stakes or tension in that battle. It was like, well, this is just a matter of time before Bo and Mando pick everybody off and before they take down the pirate ship.
There's an immediate visceral reaction where you're like, you know, as an audience member, for instance, the episode at the beginning of The Convert that we were talking about, and then the action scenes in this, the initial thing isn't an academic one. It's either, is this working for me or is it not? You know, am I invested or not? Where in this episode, you could say like, I strangely am not invested in what's happening right now.
Despite us seeing Nevarro throughout the entire series of The Mandalorian.
Right. And then the intellectual aspect of it is, okay, like, what about this from a storytelling standpoint, is making it not connect.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And Navarro is this strange thing because it is a place that has been present in the Mandalorian for so long, but it also, we never see the changes it goes through. We just arrive and it's changed.
Yep.
So that's one thing. So it's hard to become invested in a
thing.
Well,
we know no citizens of Navarro. We know Greef Karga, who, for all purposes of this, if something happened to Navarro, we know that he can just pick up and be a bounty hunter somewhere else. So there's no real concern right. for who what's going to happen to him. All of the people who are trying to escape Navarro, except for the droid smiths in Babu Frick's species, even though that, I guess, is not Babu Frick, haven't spent any time with anyone on Navarro. So there's no reason to be concerned. It's like, all right, well, too bad. And then when they all kind of like leave and are outside of the main town, it's maybe 40 people who are left. Did hundreds die in the siege? Or who?
Right.
Like, there's not a lot to be concerned about. And even in the way that we saw, what was it? The droids of the Empire, the prequel era droids, the destroyers kill Mandalorian's family in season one. That felt right. emotional. That felt a bit terrifying. I was scared for all of them in that. In this, they didn't really take that moment. It was almost all comical in the sense of the pirates are shooting them. Gorian Shard is a bit over the top and ridiculous. And the citizens are leaving. And the citizens are kind of half acting, but not really acting. There's no real right. shot of anybody dealing with trauma in this. And I don't, again, it's a light show. It's meant to be light. But it was kind of odd just to feel like there's nothing emotionally tying me to anyone here.
Well, I mean, there's an argument to be made, too, when you're making a show that's supposed to be lighter or for younger viewers, that it's like, make the stakes lower, not the consequences lower.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Where if you don't want to deal with, like, the traumatic, the narrative trauma of, like, you know, violence or their town being taken under siege, essentially, then maybe that's not the stakes you want to introduce.
Yeah.
You know? Because, like you said, it is this weird, like, light kind of... The way they treat it, they want us to both be very invested in the fact that Navarro is being taken under siege, but then they also want the citizens to kind of be, like, cartoon... Like Ewoks fighting the pirates, you know?
Yeah.
And even the Ewoks have that moment where we see like the devastating death of an Ewok, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's tough. It's also, I mean, also I can't help but think of Andor because it literally had another town and an attack on the town mm-hmm. in it. Mm-hmm. And obviously Andor had much more time and it was a much more adult show. So I'm not saying that aesthetically it needs to be the same, but thematically something similar is happening. You know, where it's just like, this is our town and someone's trying to take it. You know, there were much more political things going on in that show that were more interesting. However, the episode of Andor where they introduce that town is like the town waking up and they establish the geography of everything.
Yep.
And it's great. We see the citizens of the town, even if we don't like spend time with them specifically, we see how they move through their lives, things like that. Navarro has been a series of just kind of snippets and a town square.
Yeah.
And we don't really understand the geography of it. Like, we see a map of it where they're like, and this is like where it stretches, but it looks not like a real place. And I don't mean mm-hmm. that like, oh, it's in the volume, blah, yada, yada. I mean, they don't like do a lot to establish it as a place that people would really live. That could be in a volume. That could be all CGI. That's a narrative device of showing a place that seems real in the stakes of the show. And Navarro does not feel that way. It feels like a playset to me.
Yeah, agree. And a lot of this has continued to feel like a playset. And we know that they've talked countless times about playing with their toys, and this is their chance to play with their toys. I think before
right.
we leave...
Right, and that's totally fair. It's that it feels like toys.
Yeah, it does.
You know, it's like, you know, you watch Rebels or Clone Wars. We all know these are not real places.
Yeah.
But they feel like a real place that people exist.
Well, this is why we're only about, what, maybe 2 months away from the Navarro Town Square playset available from Kenner?
Of course, of course. And speaking of Rebel, Zeb was in this, right?
I know. Well, we should get into that. I do want, before we leave the action real quick, and I texted this to the group, and I guess I am just on this huge John Wick kick right now. But in John Wick, there's so many armored villains who are trying to get John Wick, and John Wick just always finds a way to kill them no matter what. And I'm watching all the Mandalorians slowly lumber around, and I'm like, boy, John Wick would come here and take them all out in a second. It's a good thing there's no pirates that are like John Wick. And I say that less as a joke and more of a statement of action cinema and action storytelling and speed has changed. And I feel this way. Yeah. I've been watching Poker Face, which I think is fantastic, but there's an episode that's a drag racing episode, and things don't look fast. And it's just, there's so many movies now and so much more to consume that when you see something that does it better and does things in a way that's more propulsive, that is edited in a way that just feels like there's much more pace to all of this, it makes it harder to watch something like this where it is slow and lumbering. And maybe it is just me within that, but I think it's a, I don't, when you had a little bit more of the monoculture that we had in the 90s, it was like, all right, everybody saw that action bit and they're going to try to one up it here, or they're going to try to do the same thing so that they feel like they're on the same level of what was done in some other right. film. And now everything's very disparate. And it's like, well, we can get away with doing this because we're in the volume. And there's not really going to be much movement anyway, but it just feels lacking. And again, my mind is very much forefront of having watched this recently, but I've just at times being like, wow, I don't know that we can do cinema on television and try to make it look cinematic and have it work when there are movies that spend months on fight choreography or months on car chases, and to try to shoot it in one episode, it's going to look a little bit wanting. It's not going to look enough. And I felt that a lot in this.
I also wonder, like, why, if this is the medium that you're doing it in, and you know that perhaps from a production standpoint, logistically, you don't have the time, or the, you know, you don't have the story beats to justify it, whatever it is, you know, that makes something work or not work. It's like, why would that be what you lean into? You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, I understand they have like every now and they have like big action set pieces sometimes. And sometimes it's great, like the one at the beginning of The Convert and stuff. But there is this aspect of this show that's becoming like every episode has a few big action beats, and it seems not to be anyone's favorite part of it.
Yeah.
So it's the question of like, okay, like if you don't, maybe, I mean, they have plenty of resource, but you know, there's always less than you'd want in a production like this. If you don't have the resource to execute, like, okay, we're going to have like a really tight fight or like whatever it is, like a one-on-one combat fight, whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
Then like why make that the crux of it?
It's a very good point.
When there's so many other aspects of the show that are interesting already. The best special effect on the show is a little puppet, you know?
You're right. And they're getting so far away from that. We're having episodes that really just don't even need to include Grogu at all. And yes, it's nice to have, you know, different things within this, and I think we'd be complaining if it was the same thing every week. And Mission of the Week is something that we've talked about, and this is sort of getting away from it, but also still indulging in it. It's odd in that respect. But I agree. I don't, you know, play to your strengths, play to the strengths of the show. And I think part of it is like what you've talked about, the spinning of the wheels. Well, what if we don't have any, what if we just make this episode a big action set piece? We don't need anything else. And to that being said, I want to give, we've been negative throughout this. Credit Pete Ramsey, the director of this episode, director of Into the Spider-Verse, one of the directors. Mm-hmm. He did a great job. I mean, I from what he was given, as you said, maybe the geography wasn't there, but I did feel like there was, you know, overall a well-conceived episode within this from a directorial standpoint, even if it wasn't my favorite action set piece.
Yeah, and honestly, yeah, I think that has less to do with the direction. It was all very competently put together, and the geography I don't put on how it was shot. I put on how everything has been established so far.
Yep.
You know, what if you asked me to picture Navarro, I would picture a tree that the lizards are in.
Yeah.
I would picture that little window that the Babu Fricks are in. I know that's not what they're called. And then I would picture that little circle where the IG-11 statue was.
Yeah.
And I would have like nothing else, really. Like, you know, I don't know what anyone's habitat looks like. I know that Greef Karga has that little room that he oversees everything.
But that's it. Yeah, there's not a whole lot else.
Yeah, it's just, and you have the volume. You could show us anything.
Well, and they did show us a lot more, including what essentially felt like the pilot for Rangers of the New Republic, the show that's now not happening anymore, because we get back to being with our buddy Carson Teva, who is one of the Rebellion pilots, or sorry, New Republic pilots. But we also see like a New Republic cantina hangout, which is what you talked about Zeb showing up. And I don't know. Yeah. I kind of was like, I could spend a lot of time in this. I could spend it in these Rangers of the New Republic going out and saving things on the Outer Rim and make that a mission of the week kind of show. There was a lot that was good there. And honestly, some of my favorite parts of this episode were when Carson Teva was trying to like track down, or Grief was getting the message to him in the cantina. And then his time with Tim Meadows back at the
Tim
in Coruscant.
Meadows.
I kind of liked all of that, but before we jump to Coruscant though, what do you think of this cantina for New Republic pilots, or kind of this outpost, as well as our buddy Zeb showing up?
So I like the cantina. I like that character.
Yeah.
I like it when he shows up, and the Zeb thing was cool. I obviously like Zeb as a character. I love Rebels. And they're obviously starting to kind of drip feed us that like Ahsoka's coming out soon.
Yeah.
Like that kind
of
thing. Yeah. I thought the CGI on Zeb looked fine.
Oh, it's funny. I actually had the opposite. I actually thought it looked great.
So I thought, in a world where I was like, they spent so much money on that giant crocodile.
Yeah.
I thought, but character animation is very different. I thought it looked pretty good. You know, it looked like the TV version of a movie version of that. And that's fine.
It's funny. I was very impressed. I was going to say that I thought that it looked spectacular. And I guess the thing that I thought it kind of did was animated to reality is Zeb's eyes are so telling and expressive in the animated show. And in this, they're kind of minimized.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to say I'm not speaking of the artistry of the people who made it. I'm sure that they had about 4 days to do it. and they were underbid and never paid.
Well, but we talked about it. We're hoping that this is Lucasfilm. Being that it is Lucasfilm, they're using all of their in-house team. This is a leap. I don't know for sure. But the thing that has been is that I do feel like the quality of this has been so much better than most of the Marvel movies we've seen recently in terms of the special effects that they've done.
I agree with that in terms of scale.
Yeah.
So I think comparing a TV show to the movies is a little... It's a false equivalence. But
yeah.
But... I hope that they're, listen, I hope that everyone's being paid well and treated well. And I hope, you know, and if that means that they're keeping it in-house, I would say that the chances that they're keeping all the special effects in-house is almost zero.
I'm sure you're right about that. I just meant that I felt like that they give a lot more care to it. And Chris and I talked about it in an earlier episode, because this is so inherent to Star Wars. I mean, Marvel, it is inherent to Marvel as well. But Star Wars being what it was because of the special effects that built Star Wars and made Star Wars the thing it is, to skimp in this area would be such a disappointment for Star Wars fans. But you're right.
Yeah, yeah.
They could still be outsourcing and pressuring and underpaying like the rest of the industry.
Yeah, but I don't think the special effects in Star Wars shows Star Wars anything, honestly, has never really been like the CGI aside from the prequels, obviously, but that was not a money problem. That was that they were the first through the door.
Yeah.
I don't think the special effects in a Star Wars anything being bad has ever been a concern or even a discussion, really.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The prequels notwithstanding, people had plenty of complaints about that. But in terms of since the Disney I've never heard someone say, and the CGI looks so bad.
Yeah, no.
You know,
there's that level of care.
And they have a design aesthetic that they need to adhere to, which is not the case on Marvel.
Well, true. But I also think like guys like John Knoll, and then there's a few other special effects leads at Lucasfilm. They've been doing it for 25, 30 years. And there's that pride.
Yeah.
There's that pride.
It's completely almost unanimous with the Lucasfilm brand that like things will look good.
Yep.
Sorry, we got lost.
Well, so within that, we get Teva, but then he heads to Coruscant, and we get I like the scene. I guess I just, for me, the moment was like, hey, why not Tim Meadows? This is just, cool.
Hey, man, that's exactly how I felt. And I think people should be saying this more. Why not Tim Meadows?
Well, hey, if you've watched Poker Face episode 5, nice to have Tim Meadows getting a good moment within that. I don't know if you've seen that yet, Ryan.
I haven't seen it yet, but he's great. He's Tim Meadows. Come on.
Yeah. I mean,
tell me you're not smiling when Tim Meadows shows up.
The Mandalorian has expanded.
Man?
The ladies' man. The Mandalorian has expanded, you know, who all these officers and random characters could be outside. I mean, I do love Andor using every single bit of fantastic English theater actors to come in for parts that do only like three lines. But I think, you know, the same kind of thing with The Mandalorian. It's like, well, we've always seen these officers be one way. Well, here's Tim Meadows, who is an American, and we don't need him to have a British accent, and it's fine, and he's great, and it's fun.
And listen, if you've heard Jon Favreau in an interview ever, he loves talking about how he worked as a door person at the Groundlings.
Yeah.
and he, that is his Brit, like, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know, the British Royal Academy, whatever,
Yeah, the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Wherever they teach acting, and that famous, the National Theater, his Groundlings is that.
Yeah.
He loves pulling from, that's where Amy Sedaris came from. You know, it's he loves being like, I'm Jon Favreau, and I know comedians. And hey, that's all our benefit.
And I approve this message. Amy
Sedaris is great. Tim Meadows is great. Bill Burr is great in The Mandalorian. Yeah, I don't like his comedy very much, but you know, whatever.
I still stand by, I think that Katie O'Brien, who's playing the, you know, defected, or I guess the retrained Empire, Aelia Kane, I think she's doing great work. I don't know that I know anything about what she's doing, but she's eaten up the scene as Mysterious, and you just can see the underpinning of like pure evil within her, and that just always seems to come through in everything that she's doing. And so that was probably the most actual fear that I had in the episode. Rather than the actual attack from the pirates, it was more of like, what is she playing at? What's she getting to?
Yeah.
That was where it actually kind of got to me a bit.
It was very irresponsible of that in the convert of that officer to just like leave her in that room with the dial.
Oh, like, there's incredibly irresponsible. Like,
there's no password or like key.
They're using the uniforms to designate that this is a former Empire officer or Empire, you know, Imperial, whatever, stormtrooper or shipmate or whatever it might have been. And so you'd think that everybody would just be like, well, you know, we're going to keep a little extra attention on you. We're not going to just let you go anywhere.
Just logistically, I would think that, you know, if there was like a very sensitive, like a, you know, neurosurgery machine, that the dial that decides whether it is going to kill you or not would not be something someone could accidentally lean on or like spill their coffee on.
Well, you know, it's all in service of that story, so...
That was sweaty, dude.
So, Ryan, we've talked a lot about the action in this episode. I want to talk about two other scenes that stand out to me.
Right.
The Mandalorians being convinced by Din that they're going to go and take back and help the planet, and the whole Paz Vizsla of it all. I'm just curious what you thought of that scene in the cave where he's trying to convince them. It felt very kind of basic to me, while necessary, but I did like. I did want to be like, yes, rabble, 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 rabble. Like, I just in that whole thing, I was like, why are they even trying to talk right now? Because it doesn't seem like they're actually having any of these Mandalorians and helmets say any words. They're just like, har, 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 har.
Right.
I don't know.
I mean, yeah, they needed to get them there. I don't know.
It's a necessary scene. It just didn't.
Yeah, I don't. The discourse wasn't very interesting.
No. Well,
you know, I think what happened at the end of this episode is far more interesting.
Well, that was what actually, those were the two scenes I was talking about. The second scene was this, and I wanted to talk about the discourse and the, I guess I want to know if you felt like we were building to the moment of not just Bo taking her helmet off, but I thought we were about to have like this changing of the tide entirely and that the armorer was going to take her helmet off in that moment.
I was fully wondering what celebrity cameo we were about to get when the armorer took her helmet off. That's like the whole scene. I was like, I wonder who it's going to be when she takes her helmet off.
It's been Leia the whole time.
Is it going to be like Kate Blanchett? You know?
honestly, I would just be more sad about the fact that Lydia Tarr had to work for Jon Favreau, but.
So, to me, I'm like, this is the show.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's where I like get like this is where I get like a little frustrated, because it's like with the beginning and the end of the Convert episode, even though I do think that the amnesty program thing was interesting, and I understand that it all like feeds into Moff Gideon and stuff like that. But in terms of the meat of the show, I'm like, the fact that the Mandalorians are like now being presented with an opportunity for a new homeland, essentially, that they've been taken, from the Siege of Mandalore, and that they've always been searching for it so that they don't have to move around anymore. That maybe they want to do that, but maybe it goes against their code. And this idea of, like, for us to move forward as a society, we need to, you know, meet in the middle of this kind of, like, stringent zealotry and this kind of looser interpretation of the way, right? This is all interesting. It's all done in a way that is very, I think, understandable for younger audiences. It doesn't have to be this, like, super highfalutin thing. But it's like, they keep on putting it as, like, tags at the beginning and ends of episodes. Yeah. It seems like the show is happening in the bumpers of every episode.
Well, yeah.
Where it's like the first 5 minutes, the cold open will be interesting, and then the last 5 minutes will be really interesting. And in between, I don't know, it's going to be something.
It's because they don't really have a writer doing this. I mean, they sort of do. Yeah, they don't have a writing room is part of the problem. Is they need more perspectives.
In shows in general.
Yeah.
That when there's not a writer's room, that it's an issue.
Yeah.
But I thought that was, like, interesting in the way that this is, like, the contrast between this and Andor is interesting. Because in Andor, a lot of times, the interest is the why,
mm-hmm.
you know? Like, it's a lot of, because it's a more grown-up show, they have time to go into that nuance. Tony Gilroy, that's very much his thing, is that they're talking about why these characters want to do these things, why this is meaningful.
Yeah, you got to burn your life for something.
Yeah, and Mandalorian is more surface. It's obviously supposed to be more palatable. It's the what? What are we doing? What are we moving? What is the thing that's going to move us forward? What is the thing that's interesting about this? So, you know, the literal image of a Mandalorian who has their helmet on, a Mandalorian that does not, and what that means is interesting.
Yeah.
And this is where the show is the most interesting. They just seem to, like, not want to do episodes about it anymore.
Well, make this a 6-episode show instead of an 8-episode right. show, or maybe honestly do it as a 4-part miniseries. But even if it was a 4-part miniseries, they'd then have to feel like every episode was 90 minutes, and then we'd still end up in the same place. So I don't know.
Listen, content is content. And again, if they're legitimately, I understand that this show is not, like, I am not the target audience for this show, so I'm not trying to poo-poo on the show as a thing. Like, I do enjoy it most of the time. I am very interested if there are parents out there of, like, kids who are in the target demo for this, you know, the 10 to 15 age range or whatever it is, you know, if this is really hitting for them. I imagine it is.
I think,
but I also feel like I don't hear anybody talking about this season right now.
Yeah. It's not, there's not a lot of excitement about the season.
Yeah. Which is interesting because there was so much. And I'm wondering if, you know, people are falling off after the being confused because the resolution of the show happened in a different show. Like, you know,
the cultural footprint is gone because they just gave up on one of their main storylines but not showing people. Yeah. I do have an interesting story for you about that. Not for somebody who's 11, 12, but my 5-year-old nephew was on a spring break vacation, and he recapped an episode of The Mandalorian for me. And after he was talking for about 7-8 minutes, I was sitting there. I was like, wow, that's so cool. And I was like, that's an episode I've never seen. I don't think that actually happened. I think he just made up his own episode, and I'm like, I want to see that episode. It was kind of amazing. And then I realized he was talking about where Mando was trapped in the cell of that droid in Mandalorian, right. in the depths of it. But the way he was describing it was just using words that did not connect to reality to me at all. So I was like, wow, did he just write his own story? I mean, I think this, he might be actually really talented. And then I realized he just was describing it differently than what I knew it was. But he's loving it. So
great. That's great.
A 5-year-old be watching a terrifying eye droid, you know, drain blood from the Mandalorian? That's a different conversation.
Maybe, maybe not. And you know what? The beautiful thing about Star Wars is that if the Mandalorian isn't working for me as a 35-year-old man, which is completely fair, Andor really does work for me. And you know what? They don't even owe me that. If they were like, listen, Star Wars isn't for you, man. You're too old. I'd be like, that's fair.
You're right. But I love that they are doing this to give options for both. And I would say, I do think I would be, Ryan, I don't know how we'd be doing with the podcast if Andor never existed. Because I just don't know that we'd be really excited to come and talk weekly. And just being very blunt about it. It's fun. Yeah,
and
it's
really,
fine,
that was a shot in the arm. And you know what? It'd be on us to get to a place of acceptance about
You're
that.
Right. Well,
you know what I mean?
But it's to me, it's the thing you were talking about before, is good storytelling with well thought out and, you know, not spinning your wheels episodes can still exist for kids television. There are so many good things that you and I watched growing up that did not seem like they were trying to search for a story while getting to the other story that they're telling.
I agree with the sentiment with what you, obviously, you know, with what you just said. The only thing I'll push back against is that I don't know if what we were watching was like better.
I'm thinking of Batman the Animated Series.
Sure. I mean, that's
it was always Mission of the Week with an interesting Mission of the Week, rarely having an overarching story. And I guess that's if Mando would have done that more from the beginning.
Yeah.
They kind of set it up as
the best animated show ever made.
Yeah, I know.
Or the best, I should say the best American animated show ever made. I don't know enough about international. But
I mean, exactly. Yeah. There's plenty of other things.
But I don't think I don't think if you went back and took like a focus poll of like what everything we were watching as kids, I'm not sure it would all like stand up to scrutiny of like, this was better then.
True, but this feels like the thing that is that defining thing, like what was the thing you watched as a kid? It's going to be the Mandalorian.
And you know what though? Like, yeah, because I mean, we are a generation away from Clone Wars. Because I was going to say Clone Wars was that thing, but that was 10 or 12 years ago.
It's a long time ago now.
Crazy. I think that the care and storytelling for young people in that show was you know, tremendous.
Especially when you had to kill your own brother. You know, that's something for the young people all the time. You know, there's a lot of family.
Hey man, there could be,
in this episode,
there could be nuanced storytelling that's very intense for children. It's just how it's. I think it's a delivery method, and it's how you present the stakes of things.
Yeah. Well, you know? This episode ended with a few more stakes. I don't know what you thought you were going to find in the Imperial shuttle. I expected to find something tied to the Emperor. Instead, it was more of a Moff Gideon thing. But Teva is out there, and you know that was again a little bit spooky, a little scary, and sets us up for more of what they're going to do. Yeah.
That was a really tense scene. That was really well done. It was very like procedural, so it was interesting because I find that very interesting when there's like a procedural moment. That's I think why the cantina stuff at the beginning of this episode was the most interesting, because it was like you got a call and it's like, how does this work?
Yeah.
You know, like how do they get from point A to point B?
Yeah,
but I thought that was a really tense, spooky scene. And then you know we find out that Moff Gideon has escaped, and then I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, but we basically already knew that. This is like the third or fourth time where I feel like they're giving us scenes or things that basically didn't need to happen.
A revelation of a thing that we already knew.
Yeah, I don't really get that. But Ryan, I think we kind of have to leave it there. We'll be back to talk about next week's episode, and we're getting closer. What, 3 episodes only remain? So we'll see how Mandalore. If Mandalore's rebuilt as fast as Navarro is rebuilt, the start of next season we'll have an entire like civilization of Mandalorians already out there versus just a covert.
And like a kooky shop owner and stuff. Yeah.
I'd love to see some kookiness in a Mandalorian. Maybe just a little bit of jokes. Can we get a little jokes out of
a guy with like a funny helmet? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
He has like a beer helmet, but it's like a Mandalorian helmet.
Well, that is going to do it for Wake Up with Mando. We will be back next week. Another morning edition. Why not? I think we'll go back and do it in the morning again. Ryan, I'm available. We'll make it happen.
Yeah, man.
That will do it for the droids.
Morning zoo.
That will do it for the droids you're looking for, a Star Wars podcast.
Annie, morning zoo.
You boys want to go save Navarro?
Yeah, I guess. That's kind of how it felt. Yeah. That jetpack shot where they drop out of the dropship was really cool. No, hey, it's in there now. Listen to the end. We thought the jetpack shot was really cool.